Hello, this is Randy Thompson sitting in for George Douglas. Welcome to the Triangle Radio Reading Services, The Week magazine, which offers the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And today's reading is from the issue dated September 28, 2012. The Triangle Radio Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. For the next hour, I shall be reading articles from these nine sections of The Week magazine, starting with the section called The Main Stories, and running through these sections: Controversy of the Week, Good Week 4, Bad Week 4, People, Briefing, Best Columns in the U.S., The Last Word, and ending with the Talking Points section. But first, the main stories. Anti-American riots spread. What happened? A violent backlash against U.S.-made amateur film that mocked the Prophet Muhammad continued to sweep across the Muslim world this week, with furious demonstrations taking place in at least 20 countries, including Tunisia, Indonesia, and Afghanistan. In Pakistan, two protesters died in clashes with police as thousands of people took to the streets to vent their fury at a California man's 14-minute YouTube video, Innocence of Muslims, which portrays Muhammad as a womanizer, murderer, and child abuser. In Lebanon, one demonstrator was killed as hundreds of riders went on a rampage, torching a Hardee's and a Kentucky Fried Chicken. That wave of riots began on September 11th when Egyptian Islamists seized on Innocence of Muslims, produced by Nakula Basli Nakula, an Egyptian Coptic Christian and convicted fraud who lives in Los Angeles, and breached the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. Soon after, an armed mob stormed the U.S. consulate in the Libyan city of Benghazi, killing Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. Libyan President Mohamed El-Megarif said that 50 people had been arrested in connection with the violence, which he called a pre-calculated, pre-planned attack by militants linked to Al-Qaeda. But U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, said she had seen no evidence to support that conclusion, saying instead that the attack was a spontaneous reaction to the film. What the editorial said: "Don't blame these attacks on a low-budget video," said the Wall Street Journal. "A far greater provocation to violence is the appearance of U.S. weakness that President Obama and Rice displayed after the attack in Benghazi. By denouncing the film and the Americans who made it, rather than vociferously condemning the militants who murdered Stevens, this administration only invites radicals to use more such excuses to kill more Americans." Obama did condemn the violence, said the Washington Post, by also condemning the pointlessly offensive film. Obama didn't show weakness. He undermined the radical Islamist attempts to portray the U.S. society and government as anti-Muslim. "It's vital for the U.S. to sustain its ties to moderate Islamic leaders like Egypt's President Mohamed Morsi and not force them to side with militants with an excessive show of belligerence. The future of the Arab world is up for grabs. The U.S. should be doing everything it can to tilt it in towards freedom." What the columnists say: "These attacks are just another reminder of our deteriorating position in the broader Middle East," said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. "Obama thought the region would enfold us in its warm embrace so long as we got tough with Israel, pulled out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and supported the Muslim Brotherhood in North Africa. But all we have to show after 4 years of appeasement is a revolution in Egypt that removed one of our closest Arab allies, an Iraq that's sliding into the orbit of Tehran, and a Pakistan that hates us more than ever." A more aggressive foreign policy won't frighten the militants into silence, said Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. Under President George W. Bush, there were violent raids on American embassies in Yemen, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, India, and Turkey. Those are not proof that Bush was weak or even wrong in his foreign policy. They are proof that the President of the United States is not the Lord of the Universe. It's Obama's aggression, not his supposed weakness, that inflames Muslims, said Robert Wright in TheAtlantic.com. His drone strikes have killed hundreds of civilians in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia, and are famously unpopular in the Muslim world. Going forward, America must walk a very fine line, said Michael Cohen in foreignpolicy.com. The Arab world is now in the midst of a seismic shift from autocracy to self-rule, and as we've learned in Afghanistan and Iraq over the past decade, our ability to affect outcomes thousands of miles away is at best limited. If we want any influence, we must proceed strategically and carefully, supporting civil society and pro-democracy groups, while understanding that too much meddling and intervention can result in blowback. Also under the main stories, we see this article entitled, Return of the 99%. Occupy Wall Street demonstrators took to the streets of Manhattan and other cities this week to commemorate the 99% movement's first anniversary. About 1,000 protesters marched through New York's financial district on September 17th, exactly 1 year after the movement set up camp in Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan. Police arrested 181 people as protesters chanted, "We are the 99%," and attempted to form a human chain surrounding the New York Stock Exchange. Smaller events also took place in Chicago, Seattle, and San Francisco, but none approached the scale of last year's 30,000-strong demonstrations in New York. The movement has become less visible since occupiers were cleared out of public spaces, but protesters insisted it had not disappeared. People are hurting just as much now as they were this time last year, said Ed Needham, an Occupy Wall Street spokesperson. What exactly has Occupy Wall Street achieved, said the New York Post in an editorial? It remains leaderless, purposeless, and embarrassingly irrelevant, succeeding only in providing some theater. Wall Street bonuses remain unreformed, and banking regulations are no stricter than they were a year ago, said Andrew Ross Sorkin in the New York Times. Occupy will be an asterisk in the history books, if it gets any mention at all. To see Occupy Wall Street's impact, said Stephen Zunes in CNN.com, just look at the presidential election. President Obama is running on a broad populist platform, decrying unfair tax laws and depicting Mitt Romney as the quintessential representative of the 1%. A year ago, income inequality and tax fairness were absent from the political debate. But we do have to ask, now what? Said Elliot Spitzer in Slate.com. This week's muted protest were a reminder that Occupy Wall Street has no concrete agenda for the future. My advice? Start backing real candidates who represent the movement's ethos. Occupy must either directly engage with the democratic system or fade into irrelevancy. That brings us to Controversy of the Week. This article is titled, Romney, Can He Recover from the 47% Video? Mitt Romney just lost the election, said Josh Barrow in Bloomberg.com. His Republican presidential campaign was already in chaos this week after open dissent within Republican ranks over the campaign's ineffective messaging and polls that showed him falling behind in most critical battleground states, including Florida and Ohio. Then came utter disaster A video released by Mother Jones of Romney addressing donors at a closed-door Florida fundraising dinner. In response to a question about his electoral strategy, Romney says he had no chance to win the votes of the 47% of Americans who pay no federal income tax, that these people believe they are victims and are so dependent on government handouts that they'll vote for President Obama no matter what. He added, "My job is not to worry about those people." At a hastily arranged press conference, a shaken Romney explained that he's been speaking off the cuff, and that, of course, I want to help all Americans, said Jonathan Chait in NewYorkMag.com. But it was too late. 7 weeks before the election, we've finally seen the real Mitt Romney, a sneering plutocrat with real contempt for senior citizens, the working poor, and nearly half the nation that he seeks to lead. Sure, Mitt could have phrased things more elegantly, said Michael Walsh in NationalReview.com, but if he's smart, he can use this as a Gettysburg moment to take the fight to the enemy and turn around what has been a listless campaign. Rather than apologize for his remarks, Romney should own them and explain to voters why it's fundamentally undemocratic for nearly half of the nation to pay no federal income tax, and why Americans' growing dependence on government is a threat to our national character. Romney is guilty only of telling the truth, said Michael Goodwin of the New York Post. This election really is a battle between the half of the nation that wants the government to do more and the half that knows the government already does too much. After weeks of too cautious vagueness, Romney is now liberated to make this election a clear debate over the role and size of government. Romney can't win that debate if he sounds like Thurston Howell III, said David Brooks in the New York Times. The 47% of Americans who pay no federal income tax aren't moochers. This group includes many retired seniors, low-paid veterans, and white men with high school degrees who've lost jobs and can't pay all their bills. Even though this entitlement state has expanded, America remains one of the hardest working nations on earth. Romney's ugly vision of an America divided between hard working makers and indolent takers is an ignorant country club fantasy. What self-satisfied millionaires say to each other. Don't blame Romney for echoing this gibberish, said Michael Tomasky in the DailyBeast.com. As is his wont, he was telling this particular audience what it wanted to hear. All Democrats are moochers, and all moochers are Democrats. True conservatives don't believe that, said Peggy Noonan in WSJ.com. We believe that hard work, ambition, and self-reliance are common American values, not values held by only half the nation. Romney's dismissal of so many struggling people as lazy parasites betrayed a woefully small and pinched and narrow understanding of this country. He still has time to relaunch what has been an incompetent campaign, but among Republicans there is now a broad and growing feeling that this eminently winnable election is slipping out of Romney's hands. And that brings us to the section of the program entitled Good Week 4, Bad Week 4. It's been a good week for having weird relatives. After substitute teacher Arlene Magdance of San Rafael, California, found out that she was the heir to $7 million in gold found in the Carson City, Nevada home of her late reclusive cousin, Walter Samsosky, Jr. Nobody had any clue he was hoarding the gold, said one Carson City official. And it's also been a good week for overeating. After 480-pound convicted murderer Ronald Post petitioned to cancel his scheduled execution in Ohio, arguing that lethal injection of an obese man might not work, resulting in serious physical and psychological pain. And it's been a good week for Nuki. After 7 nurseries in Denmark offered parents 2 hours of free child care on Thursday nights to give parents quality copulation time so they could make more children. And it's been a bad week for objectivity. After it was discovered that NFL replacement referee Brian Stropolo, scheduled to work a New Orleans Saints game, had a Facebook page proclaiming himself a Saints fan, with pictures of him wearing Saints gear. The NFL took him off that game. It's also been a bad week for New York City after Travel and Leisure magazine ranked it as the dirtiest city in America, with New Orleans and Baltimore second and third, respectively. New York City was also rated as the rudest and loudest city. And finally, it's been a bad week for Corey and Hope O'Kelly of Largo, Florida, whose beagle, Arnie, ate a wad of cash worth $275. The couple sifted through Arnie's poop and vomit for a week to collect shreds of money, washing it and piecing enough of it together for a bank to redeem it. Finally, only in America. Dr. Pepper has earned the ire of creationists with a Facebook ad touting the evolution of flavor. Modeled after iconic Ascent of Man illustrations, the ad shows a hunched ape-like figure mutating into a man after finding a can of Dr. Pepper. Hundreds of commentators called for a boycott. "My ancestors were created in the Garden of Eden," wrote one. "I ain't no freaking chimp." That brings us to the People section of the Week magazine, Living in Sinatra's Shadow. "Frank Sinatra Jr. has never found it easy being his father's son," said Nick Durden in The Guardian UK. "As a child, he barely saw the legendary singer, who was always busy touring or filming. He was a good father as much as it was in his power," he says. And as an adolescent, Frank Jr. kept a low profile, finding the Sinatra name a heavy burden. That didn't stop kidnappers from snatching him when he was 19 and holding him for ransom for 4 days. It was a frightening and frustrating ordeal. Frank Jr. had just launched his own musical career, and the kidnappers claimed the whole thing was a stunt staged by Frank Sr. to promote it. It wasn't. They went to jail, but the rumor persisted. "That was the stigma put on me," he says. Even so, he carried on performing, released the odd album, and toured the world. Presumably, his long career has been a fulfilling one. "Yes, but does it really constitute actual success?" he muses. "Over all these years, I've never had a hit movie, never had a hit television program, and never had a hit record. To my way of thinking, that means success has not been achieved. I have made no mark of my own creation." That, he concludes calmly, is something to be considered. And that brings us to the Health and Science section of the Week magazine. This article is entitled, "Letting Babies Cry." Allowing infants to cry themselves to sleep won't do them any harm, and it may help parents get much-needed rest. That's the finding of an Australian researcher who studied a group of 225 babies and their parents for 6 years. Half of the babies were sleep-trained by parents who either allowed them to wail for increasing lengths of time before soothing them or sat with them while they fell asleep, moving their chairs farther from the cribs each night. The other half of the babies received no sleep training. Researchers found that by age 6, the sleep-trained children were no more likely to have behavioral or emotional problems or trouble bonding with their parents than the children who weren't sleep-trained. Meanwhile, the infants who were sleep-trained woke up less during their first 2 years. Consequently, their parents got more sleep and were less likely to show signs of fatigue and depression. A big benefit for parents and kids. A well-rested parent, Judith A. Owens, a researcher at Children's National Medical Center, tells the Wall Street Journal, is going to be a better parent. You're listening to The Week magazine, and now we'll turn our attention to the section titled Best Columns in the U.S. And this section of The Week magazine includes three separate editorials, articles. First one is A Chilling Message on Free Speech, and it's by James Taranto of The Wall Street Journal. Does the right to free speech end when Islamic extremists riot? Asked James Taranto. The Obama administration has surely created that impression after Nakula Basley was dragged in for questioning by the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department this week. Nakula is the man who apparently created and uploaded to YouTube the clumsy anti-Islamic video that has triggered deadly riots throughout the Islamic world. Nakula, the sheriff said, was questioned because he had been prohibited from using the internet in the sentence he received for a 2010 check kiting scam. Though he wasn't arrested, the optics were terrible, as photos showed a terrified Nakula being escorted away by brown-shirted sheriffs, his face hidden behind a cloth. The White House made matters worse with an implicit censorship request, unsuccessfully leaning on Google to yank the video off its subsidiary YouTube. To react to the murders of four Americans this way sends a very provocative message to the radicals who attacked and burned our embassies. We can't guarantee that murder will get you what you want, but we promise we'll do our best. And then there's this piece, Tax Cuts Don't Produce Growth, and this is by David Leonhardt, New York Times. Conservatives believe, as a matter of certainty, that if you cut taxes, good times will follow, said David Leonhardt. But the history of tax cuts tells a very different story. When George W. Bush passed large tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, what followed was the slowest decade of growth since World War II. But after Bush's father and Bill Clinton each raised taxes in the early 90s, the economy boomed. When I pointed out this discrepancy to Republican Representative Paul Ryan, now the vice presidential nominee, he pointed to outside factors. A tech boom and globalization bolstered the Clinton economy, he said, while the younger Bush had to contend with the dot-com crash, 9/11, and the financial meltdowns. I wouldn't say that correlation is causation, he said. In other words, there's no actual evidence that tax cuts grow the economy. It's a matter of blind faith, whatever the facts might show. Indeed, a new nonpartisan analysis by the Congressional Research Service has concluded that since 1945, changes to the top tax rate do not appear correlated with economic growth. Explaining that reality away is one of the most serious challenges of modern conservatism. And then finally, how fracking worked better than Kyoto. This is by Bjorn Lomborg from Slate.com. Something amazing has happened, said Bjorn Lomborg. This year, carbon dioxide emissions in the U.S. have dropped to their lowest level in 20 years, down 14% from their peak in 2007. What wonderful green initiative is responsible for this dramatic turnaround? Fracking. Thanks to the natural gas boom created by drilling into shale formations, the U.S. has cut way back on its use of coal to generate electricity and shifted to gas, which emits 45% less CO2. As a result, the nation's CO2 emissions dropped by 500 megatons per year, about twice the total impact of the Kyoto Protocol on emissions throughout the rest of the world. By comparison, government investments in renewables like wind, solar, and ethanol have produced far less reduction in emissions. This breakthrough couldn't have happened without decades of government-sponsored research into fracking technology. The lesson? To combat climate change, our best bet is energy innovation that will create new sources of energy, not artificial caps on emissions that haven't worked anyway. That brings us to the last word section of the Week magazine. And this week, the title of that article is Inside the Debt Limit Showdown. The U.S. was days from default, says Bob Woodward, and Washington was playing a game of chicken. This piece is from the book titled The Price of Politics by Bob Woodward, and it was published in 2012. President Obama summoned the top four congressional leaders to the White House on Saturday morning, July 23, 2011, the night before House Speaker John A. Boehner had withdrawn from negotiations to raise the $14 trillion federal debt limit and save the government from a catastrophic default. Nobody wanted to be there, Boehner later recalled. The president's still pissed. They had about 10 days left before the government would run out of money. Given the global importance of U.S. Treasury securities, failing to extend the debt limit could trigger a worldwide economic meltdown. Boehner said he believed that he and the others, Senate Majority Leader, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader Harry M. Reid, and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi had a plan. He told Obama, "We think we can work this out. Give us a little more time. We'll come back to you. We are not going to negotiate this with you." Obama objected, saying that he couldn't be left out of the process. "I've got to sign this bill." Reid, the most powerful Democrat on Capitol Hill, spoke up. "The congressional leaders want to speak privately," he said. "Give us some time." This was it. Congress was taken over. The leaders were asking the president to leave the meeting he had called. Before the meeting, without telling Obama, the four leaders had tentatively agreed on the framework of a deal. The congressional plan guaranteed that the debt limit would have to be revisited during the 2012 presidential campaign, and Obama was insisting that any agreement would have to take the country through the election. Around 10 p.m., Obama called Boehner, who was at dinner with friends. "I'm not going to sign a bill that requires me to deal with the debt ceiling a second time before the election," the president told him. He was furious. "Listen," Boehner said he told Obama, "I understand it, but you're not going to have a choice. We've got an agreement." Obama again said he would veto such a bill. "We're too close to default to reopen the talks," Boehner said. "Congress is going to move forward on its own." The president told his senior staff that the call with Boehner had led nowhere, so we've got to figure out Plan B, which is, how do we get out of this thing, he said. The problem was that they did not have a Plan B. It was increasingly clear that no one was running Washington. That was trouble for everyone, but especially for Obama. Although running things is a joint venture between the president and Congress, a president has to dominate Congress, or at least be seen as dominating Congress. The last president to fold was George H.W. Bush, who gave in to Democrats' demands that income taxes be raised in a 1990 budget deal. And Bush had been a one-term president. Obama sent word that he wanted the two Democratic leaders at the White House at 6 p.m. that Sunday, July 24. No reason was given. Reid arrived in the Oval Office with his chief of staff, David Crone. "Harry," the president began, "I hear you have kind of an outline, a framework of something." Reid began to lay out the two-step, $2.7 trillion debt limit extension, then stopped. He was not a details guy. "Well, let David just tell you what it is," he said. It was highly unusual for someone to pass the ball so completely to a staffer. The 44-year-old crone had outlined the plan, including a secret Republican pledge to count $1 trillion in savings from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan towards deficit reduction. That was surprising. Earlier, Boehner had not been willing to accept this accounting gimmick. "I don't trust these guys," the president said dismissively. Crone either would not or could not conceal his anger. "Wait a second," Obama said, interrupting someone else who was about to speak. "I can tell David has something else to say." "Mr. President, I'm sorry, with all due respect, that we are in this situation that we're in, but we got handed this football on Friday night, and I didn't create this situation. The first thing that baffles me is, from my private sector experience, the first rule that I've always been taught is to have a plan B. And it is really disheartening that you, that this White House, did not have a plan B." Several jaws dropped as the Hill staffer blasted the president to his face. "So I don't have a lot of options in the past 36, 48 hours to put together," Crone continued. "We're supposed to be the ones that fend off an economic catastrophe, and what we find ourselves is now with no deal. We're going to have to root for the worst possible things to happen in order to prove to the Republicans that you cannot be so callous and let the debt limit expire." "That is a horrible position that we're in," Crone said. "And so this may not be the perfect deal, but it's the only deal that we have on the table right now in the situation that we find ourselves." Obama replied, "I understand what you think you're doing. I'm not doing that. The one thing that we need to bring stability to this economy is not throwing the debt limit increase back into the political arena. I'm not doing that under any circumstances. So if that means that I'm not signing this bill, I'm not signing this bill." After the meeting, Obama made a beeline for Crone. The others stepped back so the two could talk, but they still overheard the president's words. "I'm sorry," Obama said, putting an arm around Crone's shoulder. "You didn't deserve that. I know how hard you're working, and I know we wouldn't even have a chance without you." Reed gave Crone a ride back to the Capitol. The majority leader was almost like a father to him. "You stood up to him," Reed said. "He needed to hear it, and nobody was telling him." Asked later about the meeting with Reed and Crone, Obama said, "What I said to them is essentially any short-term deal is not going to be acceptable. We can go back to the drawing board, but we're running out of time. They need to understand we're not going to do a short-term deal." After more pressure from Obama, Reed split from the other congressional leaders. Later that night, he released a $2.7 trillion deficit reduction plan with a single-step debt increase that would last through 2012. 5 days later, on Friday, July 29, by a narrow margin of 218 to 210, the House passed Boehner's version of the proposal. It included the two-step procedure that the president adamantly opposed. In the White House at 10 later that night, Obama's key advisers discussed the House vote in the office of William Daley, the White House chief of staff. There was a chance the Senate Democrats would fold because the fastest solution would be to pass the House bill and get out of town for their summer recess. If the bill managed to gain Senate approval, would the president really veto it? "You can't veto," Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner told the group. "You cannot be responsible for default. Anything had to be done to prevent it, anything to preserve the global economy." "If he caves," says David Plouffe, Obama's senior political advisor, "it will have long-lasting political repercussions that we may never get out of. If we draw a line in the sand on something this important and cross it, we may never be able to come back." Geithner had to deal with the possibility that the House bill could reach Obama's desk. "My recommendation to the president would be, we've got to sign this. If that's what they offer us, we sign it." Obama appeared unexpectedly at the door. "What's going on? What are you guys talking about?" He knew, of course, they quickly recapped. "Could I actually veto it?" Obama asked, adopting his law professor manner. "What would happen on the day of the veto, the day after?" "It would have massive effects," Geithner said. Treasury had to conduct a bond auction in the open market in about 5 days, the regular Tuesday auction, with settlement on Thursday. The first auction could be a kind of tripwire setting off a chain reaction. The federal government couldn't pay its bills. Why would anyone buy U.S. bonds if it's an open question whether we're going to have the authority to pay for them? Another possible outcome, Geithner said, was perhaps worse. Suppose we have an auction and no one shows up. The cascading impact would be unknowable. The world could decide to dump U.S. treasuries. Prices would plummet, interest rates would skyrocket. The one pillar of stability, the United States, the rock in the global economy, could collapse. So, the president said, if we give $1 trillion now in spending cuts, the amount in the House bill to get the first increase in the debt ceiling for about 6 to 9 months, what happens next time? The Republicans would then come back next year, in the middle of the presidential campaign, and impose more conditions on the next debt ceiling increase. He could not give the Republicans that kind of weapon. It was hostage taken. It was blackmail. So Obama said they had to break the Republicans on this. Otherwise, they would be back whenever it suited them politically. They were out of options, Geithner said. The only one might be accepting the House bill, loathsome as it might be. The 2008 financial crisis will be seen as a minor blip if we default, he said. The president said the Republicans are forcing the risk of a default on us. I can't stop them from doing that. We can have the fight now, or we can have the fight later on. But the fight is coming to us. So no, Obama said, he was not going to cave, period, he said. Good night, got up, and left. He was very agitated. Geithner thought there was one other consideration. He did not mention it to anyone, not even the president, but he had thought about it a great deal. It was not just that Obama faced an economic choice or a political choice. He faced a moral choice. The president should not put himself in the position of saying unequivocally that he would veto, Geithner concluded, for one simple reason. No one could be sure how to put the American or the global economy back together again. The impact would be calamitous. Obama never had to confront the veto question. A few days later, House Republicans dropped their insistence on the two-step plan. The final plan accepted a debt limit increase that would take the country through the 2012 presidential contest. It also postponed $2.4 trillion in spending cuts until early 2013. The long-term deficit crisis had not been solved, but merely put off, leaving the United States at the edge of the fiscal cliff, where it remains today. And that takes us to the section of the magazine called Talking Points. And the first article is Netanyahu trying to influence the U.S. election. Iran's nuclear facilities may well be next, said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com, but Benjamin Netanyahu's first goal is clearly to blow up the U.S. election. The Israeli Prime Minister recently chastised the White House for not setting a firm red line for Iran's nuclear program that would result in a war. This week, Netanyahu doubled down with two inflammatory appearances on U.S. Sunday talk shows. Using a clumsy football analogy clearly tailored to a U.S. audience, Netanyahu warned that Iran was already in the last 20 yards in its drive for a nuclear touchdown and might be just 6 months from making a bomb. That bomb, he said pointedly, might wind up in the hands of Iran's terrorist surrogates, and the kind of fanaticism you see storming your embassies would have a nuclear weapon. Netanyahu's friend, Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney, has sought to capitalize on the rift, charging that Obama was snubbing the Israeli prime minister and throwing Israel under the bus. Never before has an American politician sided with a foreign leader in a conflict with our government, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. A war with Iran would have grave, unpredictable consequences and plunge our economy back into recession. Obama is right to resist, and he should indeed set a red line, warning Netanyahu to stop interfering in American elections. Netanyahu's behavior looks a lot like meddling, said Jeffrey Goldberg in TheAtlantic.com, but I don't think his goal is to tip the election to Mitt Romney. A veteran of countless campaigns himself, the Israeli leader can read polls as well as anyone, and has resigned himself to the idea that Obama will very likely win a second term. So why risk alienating him? He genuinely fears that Obama won't actually stop Iran from building a nuclear weapon, because he'll decide that the cost of doing so are too great. So why shouldn't Netanyahu try to sway American public opinion, said Jay Nordlinger in NationalReview.com. His nation is facing an existential threat from Iran, whose leaders have not only vowed to wipe Israel off the map, but are rapidly closing in on the technology that would make another Holocaust possible. Worse, this is a threat the wider world does not seem all that keen to confront. As Israelis, we used to this, said Danny Danin, deputy speaker of the Israeli Knesset, in the Los Angeles Times. Just prior to the Six-Day War in 1967, Egypt massed troops in the Sinai Peninsula and signed military cooperation pacts with Syria and Jordan, signaling an imminent invasion. In 1981, the madman Saddam Hussein began building the Osirek nuclear reactor to make fuel for future weapons. Both times, the international community urged us to take a wait-and-see approach. Netanyahu, a keen student of our history, knows that when it comes to Israelis' very survival, we can't wait for later. It still isn't right or smart for him to publicly scold the U.S. president, said David Ignatius in WashingtonPost.com. Obama has already stated unequivocally that his policy is to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, and has even instructed his generals to prepare a detailed plan of attack if Iran takes steps towards weaponization. But the decision to send U.S. bombers to Iran is Obama's alone. And Netanyahu should understand that no country can allow another to impose the conditions under which it will go to war. It's just as outrageous, said Eric Lewis in NewYorkTimes.com, that Netanyahu would threaten to strike Iran himself without American approval. To be sure, Israel is a special ally, but she owes her security to arms, military aid, and political support provided by the U.S. Israel has no more right to attack Iran and cause untold damage to regional stability and the U.S. economy than South Korea has to unilaterally attack the mad nuclear-armed regime in North Korea. Netanyahu has every right to defend Israel and to doubt Obama's commitment to stopping Iran, said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. Sanctions have done nothing, and indeed the International Atomic Energy Agency reports that Iran's nuclear program is accelerating. Of course it is. Obama refuses to set any line beyond which Iran must not go, leading every sensible person, including the mullahs in Tehran, to conclude that he'll allow Iran to go nuclear. No wonder Netanyahu now seems panicky. Not since its birth 6 decades ago has Israel been so cast adrift by its closest ally. And this article under Talking Points, entitled Cheating in School, Why It's on the Rise. Have we raised a generation of cheaters? Asked Robert Kolker in New York Magazine. That's the question people are asking after a series of major cheating scandals involving some of the nation's top schools and colleges. New York City's prestigious Stuyvesant High School this month suspended 12 students and threatened to suspend 50 more for allegedly sharing test answers via text and email. Weeks earlier, Harvard University accused 125 undergrads of sharing and plagiarizing answers for a final take-home exam. Recent research shows that 85% of high school students cheat. This might be because students today face enormous pressure, as early as fourth grade, to succeed on high-stakes tests that they're told will determine their entire futures. Now that schools prize test performance over learning, cheating becomes rational, said Steve Gimbel in InsideHigherEd.com. Indeed, cheaters are admired for having beat the system. For the millennial generation, in fact, cheating is a foreign concept, said Lauren Stiller Rickling in the Boston Globe. Having grown up online, immersed in Wikipedia and Facebook, they think it's perfectly normal to share information and even intimate personal secrets. To them, passing around test answers isn't really cheating, just as downloading music from file sharing sites isn't really stealing. Lazy teaching only makes matters worse, said Zara Kessler in Bloomberg.com. The exam paper at the center of the Harvard scandal was open book and open internet, meaning students could research their answers almost any way they wanted. Is it any wonder students decided that collaborating on the answers was no big thing? To find out what students really have learned, schools must demand that they shut the laptops altogether. How do we convince kids not to cheat? Asked James Crow, Jr. in the Springfield, Illinois Times. When society's most successful people cheat all the time. We know now that bankers rig the interest rates they charge each other, pocketing billions. Big Pharma phonies up the drug trials. Famous singers lip-sync at concerts. Admired athletes like Lance Armstrong illegally use drugs to become rich and famous. And how many ordinary Joes cheat on their taxes and their spouses? So before we dismiss an entire generation as morally flawed, maybe we should take a look at who taught them to play dirty in the first place. And finally, under Talking Points, we see this article entitled, Bernanke, Trying to Save Obama? The U.S. economy got a badly needed boost last week, said Josh Barrow in Bloomberg.com. The Federal Reserve announced a third wave of quantitative easing, printing money to buy bonds from big banks to keep interest rates down. But where two previous efforts by the Fed to pump money into the system have been temporary, QE3 will be open-ended and thus vastly more effective. Ben Bernanke, chair of the Federal Reserve, has pledged to buy $85 billion of mortgage bonds every month until January, and another $40 billion every month after that, for as long as necessary. The assurance of long-lasting Fed stimulus will boost stocks and home buying, making consumers feel more confident and more inclined to spend money, leading to new hiring. It's a win-win-win. For a long time, Bernanke was resistant to QE3, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com, because of intense Republican opposition. But slowing economic growth and stubborn unemployment made him decide the Fed had to act. Bernanke's desperate intervention is not only unlikely to save the economy, said Larry Kudlow in NationalReview.com, it's a blunt admission that Obama economics has completely failed. The Fed has already spent $2.35 trillion on previous bond buying schemes with no apparent impact on the economy. Further quantitative easing will only weaken the U.S. dollar, drive up food and energy prices, and hurt the middle class. As Mitt Romney said last week, we should be creating wealth, not printing dollars. And why choose to bail out Obama now? Said Investors Business Daily in an editorial. A major Fed action coming just before an election is highly suspect. If Bernanke's goal was to influence the election, said Michael Tomosky in the DailyBeast.com, he'd have done this in the summer. QE3 won't have much of an impact on the economy before November. He's also made it clear that the Fed's influence over the economy is limited, said the Washington Post. Only the President and Congress can restore real confidence by devising a credible fiscal plan to get the deficit under control and avert the fiscal cliff looming at the end of the year. Bernanke's bond-buying program has bought both sides some time. If our elected leaders continue to delay, the day of reckoning will be in the same sinking boat as Europe. And on that same Talking Points page, we see the following. Poll Watch. 45% of Americans who say they followed the news about attacks on U.S. embassies in the Middle East approve of President Obama's handling of the attacks. 36% disapprove. 26% approve of Mitt Romney's attempt to blame Obama for the attacks. 48% disapprove. That's Pew Research Center. 70% of Americans support efforts to require voters to show a photo ID card at the polling place, and 28% oppose voter IDs. This is from the New York Times CBS News poll. And under Wit and Wisdom, we see this quote by columnist Bill Vaughn, quoted in Forbes.com. A real patriot is the fellow who gets a parking ticket and rejoices that the system works. And under Noted, the financial crisis may cost the U.S. almost $13 trillion. Better Markets, a nonprofit agency, calculates that the crisis will cost the country $7.6 trillion in gross domestic product and $5.2 trillion in various government stimulus measures. That's from the Washington Post. The Boy Scouts of America did not report 80% of the 500 allegations of child sexual abuse it received over several decades to police. A review of its confidential perversion files has found most volunteers or employees accused of abusing Boy Scouts were allowed to quietly leave for false reasons to protect the organization's reputation. That was in the Los Angeles Times. Decades of overfishing for cod have left fewer than 100 fully grown adult cod in the North Sea, according to a new study of catches at North Sea ports across Europe. Almost all cod are now caught before they reach sexual maturity, leaving very few cod in the sea to reproduce. That's from the Sunday Times, UK. Most readers of young adult fiction aren't actually that young. A new study from Bowker Market Research found that 55% of customers who buy young adult novels like The Hunger Games and Twilight are 18 and over, with most admitting to buying the books for themselves, and that's from csmonitor.com. And finally, from the New York Times, we see this little piece under Noted. In order to get extensive access to President Obama for a new book and Vanity Fair profile, author Michael Lewis agreed to give the White House approval over all Obama quotes. Quote approval, often seen by journalists as an unacceptable form of censorship, is often now a prerequisite for interviews of business executives and celebrities. And under the section entitled The U.S. at a Glance, we see these various articles. From Wilmington, North Carolina, fatal vision case. More than 30 years after he was convicted of brutally killing his pregnant wife and two young daughters, Jeffrey McDonald, a Green Beret, an Army doctor, is getting another chance to prove he is innocent. Witnesses testified at a hearing this week that a now-dead blonde woman with a history of drug abuse said she was at McDonald's home the night of the attack, along with a group of men who slaughtered the family. McDonald, 68, who is serving three life sentences, has consistently said the murders were committed by drug-crazed hippies, including a blonde woman who had chanted, "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs." The court case inspired the bestseller Fatal Vision. McDonald's defense is also expected to provide DNA and other evidence collected since his 1979 conviction. And from New York City, soda ban passed. Supersized sodas and other sugary beverages will not be sold in restaurants and movie theaters in New York City next year, after the city's Board of Health last week approved Mayor Michael Bloomberg's controversial ban. The measure, which goes into effect in March 2013, will prohibit the sale of sugary drinks in containers larger than 16 ounces in an effort to tackle the city's growing obesity problem. The city's health department estimates that half of all adult New Yorkers are now overweight or obese. The ban has been condemned by the soft drink industry, and polls show only 40% of New Yorkers support it. But a large loophole in the law means that only establishments that are graded by the health department are subject to the new rules, so supermarkets and convenience stores will be exempt. Bloomberg predicted other cities would soon take similar steps to fight obesity. We believe that it will help save lives, he said. And from Chicago, teachers suspend strike. Thousands of Chicago children returned to school this week after teachers voted to end a strike over a series of reforms proposed by Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Union delegates voted to go back to work after 7 days on the picket line, having reached a settlement with school authorities on job security and teacher evaluations. The union won a concession that will tie teachers' assessments to students' progress in general, with less emphasis on standardized test scores. The settlement also contained an average 7% pay raise over 3 years to compensate for lengthened school hours requested by Emanuel. Karen Lewis, the fiery president of the Chicago Teachers Union, said that while the deal did not solve all the problems of the world, it was good enough to suspend the strike. Emanuel called it an honest compromise. And finally, from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, voter ID law blocked. Less than 2 months before the presidential election, Pennsylvania's highest court temporarily blocked a controversial new law requiring voters to show photo identification. The 4-2 decision by the state Supreme Court sends the case back to Commonwealth Court Judge Robert Simpson, who upheld the law in August, instructing him to provide proof that there will be no voter disenfranchisement arising out of the ID requirement. State Republicans who passed the law have long suspected voter fraud in parts of Philadelphia, but Democrats say there is no evidence of abuse, charging that the GOP is trying to make it harder for the elderly, the disabled, minorities, the poor, and students to vote. The state has reported that 750,000 registered voters do not have an acceptable ID as defined by the law. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Week. Be sure to listen again at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, filling in for George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Services wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleredingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please don't hesitate to contact us at 919-832-5138. So long. Until next time.